programs and interfaces and using geotagging protocols. The CIA also recently funded Clearista, a company that collects DNA. A 2012 paper by the CIA's venture capital firm, NQTEL, mentioned the increasing use of social media surveillance by government agencies for tracking general trends, as well as containing social movements, epidemics, and crises.
Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield got busted, better known as Ben and Jerry, whose names are still seen on the containers of ice cream they originated. The two men were arrested for something they've been doing for many years, advocating for social change. Ben and Jerry were among 300 people arrested and released at the U.S. Capitol on Monday for participating in Democracy Spring protests, calling for campaign finance reform and reform of voting rights.
It's 5:12. Time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It took him some 80 years, but he has now made what looks to be a full comeback to power. He is Herbert Hoover. With the Great Depression spreading misery across America, President Hoover's prescription was to insist on reducing the size and spending of governments in order to boost business confidence. Hoovernomics was a disaster for our country, and it was not good for him. He lost the presidency in 1932 to FDR. So here we are in a new century with widespread, relentless unemployment, mass underemployment, stagnant wages, a rapidly falling middle class, and dimming economic prospects even for college-educated young Americans. In the face of this destabilizing, inegalitarian pressure on our economy and society, what remedy are America's corporate and political leaders demanding? Hoovernomics. Not a single jobs bill is in the congressional hopper. Despite rhetoric about a new green economy, the White House has offered no job creation plans at all. Instead, Washington's entire energy is going down the Hoover hole of restoring business confidence. The deficit is the devil, cry the new Hooverites, as they wildly slash spending and try to kill federal programs like Head Start that lift people up. Not to be outdone, a covey of extremist right-wing governors are demonizing, disempowering, and firing thousands of public employees. These little Hoovers maniacally shriek that with state revenues down and so many families out of work, the smart thing to do is to eliminate more jobs. They're shoving teachers, firefighters, and other public employees out the door, thus shutting off the taxes that these employees pay to the state while simultaneously increasing the number of out-of-work people looking for jobs. This is Jim Hightower saying, if ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Hoovernomics is back, as goofy and destructive today as it was last century.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A group of doctors is among the latest to speak out about the potentially hazardous effects of climate change. Yesterday, the American College of Physicians called for aggressive and concerted action to fight climate change in a paper published online in the Annals of Internal Medicine. The paper pointed to an array of health concerns that could be directly related to increasing temperatures and changing weather patterns. The Zika virus has been the latest of infectious diseases to be presented in the news, but others, such as dengue fever and cholera, are also being increasingly seen in the United States. This could be because mosquitoes that carry those viruses thrive in warmer weather. In addition, respiratory illnesses are exacerbated by elevated pollen count and air pollution, while heat stroke and dehydration prevail from rising temperatures. Taken together, the extensive list of health concerns makes it easy to see why many health agencies are saying that there is cause for alarm. This declaration from the American College of Physicians is merely the most recent and echoes similar statements from the Center for Disease Control and the World Health Organization.
Both the Federal Reserve and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation have issued reports on the status of America's biggest banks, saying the banks are still too big for America's safety. These are the same banks that had to be considered too big to be allowed to fail during the 2008 worldwide financial crisis. At that time, the banks had to be propped up with massive infusions of cash from the federal government. Legislation passed in 2010 requires banks to set up what are called living wills that are periodically filed with regulators, detailing how the banks plan to enter bankruptcy in an orderly fashion. This would be a critical step in avoiding a financial crisis such as the one faced in 2008. Reports say that of the nation's eight largest banks, five of them, including Bank of America, JPMorgan Chase, Wells Fargo, lack credible plans for meeting such a crisis. Neel Kashkari, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, has been calling for the breakup of the nation's largest banks, which are now actually bigger than they were before the 2008 crisis.
The U.S. Supreme Court could be evenly divided in a Texas-led challenge to President Obama's executive action on immigration. The case was brought by a coalition of 26 states challenging two immigration programs designed to protect qualifying members of mixed-status families from deportation. The first would expand Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, while the second would extend DACA-like status to undocumented parents meeting certain criteria. The latter program is called Deferred Action for Parental Accountability, or DAPA. Immigration reform advocates hope that Chief Justice John Roberts will side with his liberal counterparts in order to find that Texas doesn't have the constitutional footing to challenge the actions. That would shore up a majority to overturn a lower court ruling to halt the actions. But that didn't seem to be the case during Monday's proceedings when Roberts appeared sympathetic to the challengers. Should he side with conservatives on the still eight-justice panel, the bench will tie and the lower court's ruler blocking the executive actions will stand. FSR and Lena Nosiwe reports that the court's decision will affect millions of undocumented immigrants in the United States, including a population rarely considered.
There's not one particular experience I could pinpoint to be the worst experience. I think the overall experience is magnificently hard.
For more than 20 years, Gabrielle Jackson was a member of what she describes as an invisible, lonely, and mostly secret society. The population of around 400,000 to 600,000 undocumented immigrants of African, Afro-Latino, and West Indian descent living in the United States. She was only 9 when she arrived in America from Trinidad.
I had this loneliness, complete isolation, and feeling like I was alone because of the fact that, you know, I didn't feel like there was anybody else in my situation, because when it looked like immigration, it totally focused on being Latino, not being Afro-Latino, not being within the diaspora, specifically most times having to do with Mexico.
Latinos do make up an estimated 59% of undocumented immigrants, although immigration attorney Sharon Williams contends Asians may make up a larger percentage than most estimates indicate. Williams, who practices in Northern California, says in some cases and some places, stereotyping allows Black undocumented immigrants to come under less scrutiny.
In the Bay Area, there's not a sense that people of African descent are immigrants. There's not a sense of that. So that has pluses and minuses, because one of the things that's a plus is that when undocumented Black people in the Bay Area interact with the criminal justice system, their immigration status is not typically questioned because they're assumed to be African American, right? So in a sense, to me, that's a good thing, you know, until the system catches up with them. So there's a side of me that wants to keep that silent. You know, because we don't see, in the Bay Area, we do not see a lot of people of African descent in detention centers or in detained court. So you'll see them in the regular immigration courts, but not typically in detained. And so it is quite unusual. Now you switch that to someplace like Los Angeles, San Diego, New York City, Washington, D.C., those places where there is a culture of Black immigration, that's one of the first things that they check.
The advocacy group Black Alliance for Just Immigration says nationally, undocumented Black immigrants are detained and deported at 5 times the rate of others with similar status. Complicating the issue is that Black undocumented immigrants hail from far-flung locations, including sub-Saharan Africa, the Caribbean, and Latin America. Immigrants from around the world came together in Los Angeles earlier this month at the Black Immigration Network Kinship Assembly to share their stories.
I guess time is gone, but I just wanted to say, keep at it, keep going.
That includes Rhea, a mother of four who was born in Belize and is Garifuna.
Oh, when I tell people I'm undocumented, it is the strangest thing for them, because they look at me and they just look at me as just a Black face, right? And unless I make a conscious effort or a conscious decision to speak in my accent, that's when it's known that I'm a foreigner. And then the added piece of the undocumented part of it, it's a very different thing for people. It's an absolutely very different thing for people.
She gets emotional when she talks about the toll of living without immigration papers for almost 30 years.
And saying to myself, oh my gosh, I have no means of being able to be employed. Rent is due, this is due, that is due, and I'm of no use to myself or to my children. Let me kill myself. You know, that's one of my breaking points that I had.
But she survived her suicidal days and obtained legal status 2 years ago. Gabrielle Jackson of Trinidad also experienced the anxiety of living in the shadows of U.S. immigration policy until she qualified for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, an executive order signed by President Barack Obama that gives temporary legal status to young immigrants who meet a set of strict criteria.
I qualified for DACA in 2012 and eventually was able to adjust my status in 2015, but having papers does not erase the trauma.
Jackson is one of the original core committee members for the UndocU Black Network, which she says helps to facilitate access to resources. And in her words, they blackify the undocumented immigrant narrative. Attorney Sharon Williams describes U.S. immigration laws as draconian, with a bias in favor of immigrants from Europe and Japan, but that overall, the system has a higher level of civic engagement than in many other countries.
You know, when I make a comparison with countries like Dominican Republic or countries in Asia, countries all over Europe, and, you know, what's happening in Europe right now, where borders are being shut to people who are really in serious trouble, I compare the American immigration system. We have a way to dialogue about these issues. At least we're talking about it, and people have the opportunity to fight for legalization. I think that's a critical difference. I'm not saying we should not criticize. We should absolutely criticize the system. And that is how we make changes, right, is by criticizing the system.
The issue is a personal one. Williams is Garifuna and originally from Belize. She was once undocumented herself, but eventually became a citizen through the amnesty process of the immigration reform passed during the Reagan years. The 1986 overhaul was the last time Congress had the will to comprehensively address the nation's undocumented population. The most sweeping reforms since then have come via executive order. With the fate of DAPA and the expansion of DACA in the hands of a Supreme Court, one justice short of a full bench. 30 years later, Williams hopes lawmakers will find the political courage to pass comprehensive immigration reform that goes beyond DACA, the executive order she describes as a band-aid. The Supreme Court is due to rule on DAPA and the expansion of DACA sometime in June. Lenin Ozizwe, FSRN, Los Angeles.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Next up is Cutie Pock Talk, whose April show focuses on National Poetry Month with guest Manuel Arturo Abreu at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is rainy and warm, with a chance of thunderstorms and highs near 80 degrees. Today in history, in 1865, Abraham Lincoln's funeral was held at the White House. He had been assassinated 5 days earlier and was shot to death by John Wilkes Booth in Ford's Theater. The quote of the day is from abolitionist Frederick Douglass, who said, "It is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men."
And again, you are listening to the KBOO Tuesday Evening News. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Earth and Spirit Council, presenting an Earth Day All Species Celebration, Sunday, April 24th at Mount Tabor Park. Attendees are invited to come dressed as their favorite species or Earth feature. The event includes live music by Quincy Davis and friends, mask making, and more. Information is available at Earth and Spirit Council's Facebook page.
The Government Accountability Office reports that rape victims face a shortage of medical examiners qualified to collect evidence on their behalf, especially those who live in rural areas. The issue is of key importance because of collection of evidence is very time sensitive with respect to rape cases. Oregon is one of six states studied for the Accountability Office report, along with Florida, Massachusetts, Nebraska, Wisconsin, and Colorado. New statistics by the U.S. Department of Justice say that nearly one in five women in the United States has been sexually assaulted, and only 2% of rapes lead to a conviction.
Title IX is being evoked in a fight taking place to allow transgender high school students to use the bathroom. A federal appeals court in Richmond, Virginia, has deferred to the U.S. Department of Education's interpretation of Title IX that gives transgender students access to bathrooms that match their current gender identities rather than their biological sex. Title IX refers to the legal requirement prohibiting gender discrimination in any educational program or activity. Schools or institutions found to be in violation of Title IX risk losing federal funding. The decision may have wide-reaching ramifications, particularly because the states of North Carolina and Mississippi have both passed laws focusing on fixed and binary gendered bathroom use. The recent laws in Mississippi allow schools to require students to dress and use the bathroom that conforms to their gender at birth. The Obama administration has already stated that failure to accommodate transgender students is a Title IX violation, and such schools may risk the loss of federal funding. Unfortunately, several lower courts have gone against the Obama administration's position, assuring that the battle for the bathroom will play out in many U.S. courts in the future.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox Sr. says an effort is underway to try to privatize the Veterans Administration health care system. Cox says the privatization threat comes from a VA commission appointed by Congress that includes a fake Koch brothers-affiliated veterans group.
One of the appointments was the Koch brothers' fake veterans organization, Concerned Veterans of America. We're very, very concerned. There's a lot of private health care individuals, things of that nature, on this, and it's about how do you privatize the VA, the best health care system in this country, how do you basically destroy it?
Cox says if Congress properly funded and staffed the VA, the long waiting lines and other problems veterans are experiencing would be resolved.
There's long lines because the health care is so good, veterans want to be in. Congress has not appropriately funded the VA. That has created a lot of the problems. The VA currently has almost 40,000 vacant positions. Can you imagine if they filled all those positions, we would see these lines diminish and we would see veterans receiving the health care that they deserve.
Temp workers who threatened to walk off their jobs at the Detroit Chassis Auto Parts plant in Avon, Ohio, called off the strike after the employer agreed to their demand to join the UAW. Some of the workers are paid as little as $9.50 an hour. The UAW says the workers were fed up with low pay, no benefits, and permanent temp status. The UAW says a walkout by these workers would have stopped production within a day at Ford's Ohio assembly plant. That plant builds F-650 and F-750 trucks. Detroit Chassis started operations last year about a mile from the Ford plant, and they haven't hired a single permanent worker. Auto parts workers at other plants are also trying to organize with the UAW. The union says the Detroit Chassis workers should be an inspiration for workers everywhere. Hundreds of non-tenure track faculty at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign campus walked off their jobs for a two-day strike Tuesday. Sean Gilmore is president of their faculty union affiliated with the AFT. Gilmore says the faculty who walked out for the two-day strike want the stability of multi-year contracts.
So the main things that we're striking over today are issues of stability and professionalism. We need multi-year contracts for these individual employees. We'd also like to see clear promotion pathways as well as a general improvement in the shared governance of the institution.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor is the bank with products and services designed to serve the needs of unions and their members. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Brazil's lower house of Congress approved a measure Sunday to move forward with the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. Rousseff, who is accused of authorizing an accounting trick to minimize the appearance of state budget deficits ahead of her re-election campaign, denies any wrongdoing. Her supporters compare the impeachment to a coup attempt. Complicating matters, many of the lawmakers who voted in favor of removing Rousseff were actually under investigation for crimes like bribery and money laundering. From the capital, Brasilia, FSRN's Sam Cowie reports.
Senhoras e senhores, Pernambuco!
As Rousseff's impeachment count edged close to the 342-vote threshold, opposition lawmakers in Brazil's lower house of Congress could barely contain their excitement. During the process, lawmakers each gave 30-second explanations of the motives behind their votes. Few of her opponents mentioned the fiscal responsibility crime she is accused of.
Pela minha família, pelo povo brasileiro, pelos evangélicos da nação toda.
Conservative legislators instead peppered their speeches with references to family, God, and the future of Brazil, with allusions to North Korea or Venezuela. Lawmakers voting in favor of impeachment included hardline evangelical pastors, gun lobbyists, and outspoken admirers of generals who had committed torture during Brazil's military regime. One of the lawmakers is even wanted by Interpol and cannot leave Brazil. To top it off, the man who led the impeachment push, lower house speaker Eduardo Cunha, is himself facing charges of money laundering and bribery. Rousseff and her supporters have repeatedly alleged that she is the victim of political persecution and that what is happening amounts to a coup. The impeachment measure now goes to Brazil's Senate for a vote. If a majority of senators vote in favor, which now seems likely, Rousseff will have to immediately stand down. Vice President Michel Temer would take over as interim president, while Rousseff has 6 months to prepare her final defense before the case goes to the Supreme Court. Sam Cowie for FSRN, Brasilia.
ISIL is losing territory and income to the tune of 30% over the past year. According to the Colorado-based consulting group IHS, revenue for ISIL is split almost 50-50 between oil production and taxes that it collects in the areas it controls in Syria and Iraq. U.S.-led airstrikes, in conjunction with ground resistance by Kurdish groups like the YPG and Peshmerga, are said to be responsible for the weakening of ISIL. An IHS analyst observed recently that, quote, the Islamic State is still a force in the region, but this drop in revenue is a significant figure and will increase the challenge for the group to run its territory in the long term, end quote. ISIL is said to be exploring alternative income sources, including taxing its subjects for not being able to answer questions from the Quran.
Now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings, you're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Last May, I produced a KABU commentary that generated outrage from a few of my listeners. It was titled, Anti-LNG Rally in Salem Confuses the Public About Where Real Power Resides. And in it, I dared to make the claim that the strategies and tactics being used by the No LNG Exports Coalition in their campaign to stop the proposed Jordan Cove LNG shipping terminal in the Coos Bay area and the proposed Pacific Connector LNG pipeline across the southwest corner of Oregon were not as effective as they needed to be if the goal was to stop these projects once and for all. I was accused of being uninformed and of offering sentiments based on misinformation and condescension. I did nothing of the sort. It continues to trouble me that it's considered socially unacceptable for politically active people to critique the effectiveness of other politically active people's campaigns. Our world is in crisis, and our activism needs to be as wise and focused and visionary and bold as it can possibly be. So yes, I do see it as my duty to critique activism that I believe could be a lot more effective. And in my opinion, it's your duty too, dear listener. We are all in this together, and time is short.
I'm again discussing this year-old commentary because just this past month, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, denied the permit that would have allowed this ecologically catastrophic project to move forward, and Oregon's anti-LNG activist groups declared it a great victory. But Mary Guedry, who's been a leader of the Coos Commons Protection Council, the local community rights group based in Coos Bay that has drafted the Coos County Right to a Sustainable Energy Future Ordinance, which will likely be on the ballot this November, wrote an op-ed in her local Coos Bay newspaper, The World, that could be summed up in three words, not so fast. Here are some excerpts from Mary Guedry's March 19th op-ed. An affected landowner called to give me the good news. "Did you hear? FERC denied Jordan Cove," she said. "It's over." I was so shocked and excited, I instantly pulled up the just-released order on my phone. My joy soon turned to disappointment. Make no mistake, this is a momentous moment and will have the effect of deterring both the terminal and pipeline for the foreseeable future, but it isn't over. The FERC denial was made without prejudice, meaning both companies can reapply. In fact, both have declared their intention to demand a rehearing. That, however, is not what is so disappointing. After the thousands of hours spent abiding by the regulatory rules and the reams of paper representing thousands of substantive comments and expert testimony about the negative impacts upon waterways and forests and oysters and clams and birds and the very air we breathe, the denial came down to just one thing: the market. The FERC denial order is far from a victory and little more than a respite. The single most effective strategy employed by Jordan Cove opponents was that more than 90% of landowners refused or failed to negotiate an easement. If the company comes up with a buyer, or worse, partners with a bigger player that already has customers, then nothing short of a tsunami or a countywide bill of rights for a sustainable energy future will stop it. Yes, some inexplicably are still determined to keep on participating in and validating the regulatory process, but many see the urgency and opportunity to enact new rules. Even more than an outright approval, FERC's denial of Jordan Cove's Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity purely on market grounds is a virtual endorsement for the community rights movement, because common sense and traditional activism clearly are not working. At the other end of the pipe, Colorado community rights activists are also pleased that Jordan Cove has been indefinitely delayed, as they vigorously fight hydraulic fracturing used to extract natural gas destined for Jordan Cove. Colorado, like Oregon, has a proposed state constitutional amendment that would affirm local decision-making powers and prevent state preemption of local rights-based ordinances. I've been reading excerpts from the March 19th op-ed by Mary Guedry, a leader of the Coos Commons Protection Council, the local community rights group based in Coos Bay that has drafted the Coos County Right to a Sustainable Energy Future Ordinance, which they hope to place on the ballot in November. You can follow their work at cooscommons.org, and Mary's blogs can be read at guedry.com. That's GEDDRY.com. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter as cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Longshanks, Martin Dodge, and Dominic Anaya. The producer is Kanan Schlesinger. Special thanks to Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jenna Yokoyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7 it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland speaks with David Ray Griffith about his book, Unprecedented. Can Civilization Survive the CO2 Crisis? At 9, we hear activist and writer Angela Davis speaking on transnational solidarity from the series Alternative Radio. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on The Food Show, host Chris Siegel speaks with Portland native Marissa McClelland, who runs the food site Food in Jars, Annie Novak, who runs the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm. This is the KBOO Evening News. Good night, Jenna.
Night, Kanan. Night, Sequoia.
Good night.
Take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Last week was the first anniversary of Freddie Gray's death while in custody of the Baltimore Police Department. KBOO's Doug McVeigh was in Baltimore this week and talked with Gray's family attorney, William Murphy Jr., to find out the latest in the story and how it continues to impact communities around the nation.
Since the murder of Freddie Gray and the uprisings, and we've had the growth of Black Lives Matter and politicians paying amazing amounts of lip service to what needs to be done. It's been a year out. What's changed?
Nothing's changed, which means that, in fact, things have changed for the worse because the cycle of poverty gets worse all by itself, and only 10% of the people in poverty ever get out of it. And so unless you do something radical to reverse poverty, it's here to stay. And none of the politicians up to this point in time in Baltimore have put a dent in it because it's gotten progressively worse from the time that we had Mayor Schaefer to the time that we had Mayor Blake. So it's a sorry lack of effort, A, and B, it's a lack of intellectual effort to come up with the solutions to this problem, and we ought to be able to do it. We ought to be able to solve it. And these kids are at risk because as long